Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, joining in from the chilly confines of the Hertz bunker, waiting for my butter to become soft, and by the looks of it, it's not going to, so...
Of all the news stories I thought they were going to float to the surface this week, the great Buttergate scandal of 2021 would not have been my first guess.
It was number one on the BBC for a day, the Canadian butter saga. So I don't know if that's just
It was trending. It was trending on Twitter. I think it was trending earlier today, too. It's a thing.
Canadian butters need to work for a while, and I think we should make it a topic for a future date. Get some Aggie in to discuss it. Actually, oh. I was one, so I can talk butter all day.
You're right. We are ideally situated to get to the bottom of this, and if it's not going to be us, then who? Anyway,
the time has come.
The time has come.
Great Buttergate 2021.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians. This week, though, it is just the news, including the provincial government's sudden interest in protecting the environment, even though they're building a new highway through much of it. And then Facebook basically held Australia's news business hostage for a week till the government there gave up on any notion of making them pay for the news. So why is Canada looking to repeat that process? And finally, we will mark 25 years since the Shawinigan handshake, and whether we need to come to terms with the fact that the Prime Minister of Canada once assaulted a guy on camera and then acted like it was basically the funniest thing ever. But first, there was the Conservative motion this week. They had opposition day, so everyone got to dust off stuff from the old desk and bring it forward. This one was a success, though, which is something you can't always say about opposition day motions. So Erin O'Toole, leader of the Conservative Party, brought forward a motion to declare the genocide of the Uyghurs a genocide. We've talked about this before. We had Graham McNaughton on to talk about the issues of forced labor in places where there are the quote-unquote re-education camps for the Uyghurs, and that's a small part of it, but there has been further reports, a lot of it done by the BBC, that in these quote-unquote re-education camps that there is also torture and assault, sexual abuse, rape, gang rape in one case. So it's pretty brutal for what's happening to the Uyghurs. Canada is now basically one of two countries to call it straight up a genocide. And I guess the question is, how is that going to, I guess, do anything?
And that's it, because it's a non-binding symbolic motion. So it's not as if a law was passed saying we are going to do this because China is doing that. Mm-hmm. So to me, this seems like a very kind of cynical attempt to try and score points and make the Liberals look weak.
Mission accomplished, by the way.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But should you be using something like a genocide to try and score political points? Because as we know, there are a lot of situations in the world right now that could definitely qualify as genocide without naming names, but you can guess. And yet there's nothing on that. It's specific to China, and simply because our relationship right now is so poor. And in trying to get the Trudeau Liberals to take some kind of stance on this, they are kind of sticking the knife in a little bit. There was an amendment to this motion as well about from the Bloc asking the IOC to move the Olympics from Beijing in 2022. And it's not going to happen. You know, Dick Pound will come and punch you out if they mess with the Olympics, right? The official line on that is like, well, the Olympics are non-political. The Olympics have not been non-political probably since Munich in 72. Mm-hmm. Maybe the last non-political Olympics were the ones in Montreal in 1976. Regardless of how you slice it, the Olympics is a political event. So I can see why the Bloc wanted to try and tie that into this resolution as well. Final numbers, what, 266 out of 338 in favor of this motion, but the Liberal cabinet abstained. And it's understandable as to why they would do that. But then I happened to hear Mark Garneau, one of those who abstained, getting stuck into China. I think it was on Tuesday, trying to have it both ways. So abstaining on this motion, then saying, no, they really need to do this and this and this and this. So it, pretty much mission accomplished, as you say, the Conservatives and co had, let's just say, scored one against the Liberals. But I think it's brief and fleeting, probably.
Well, it is brief and fleeting because, I mean, as you said, it's non-binding. And what are the odds that the government's going to go, oh, well, I guess they passed this motion anyway. I guess we're going to have to proceed with it. Of course they're not. It's pointless because, yeah, Mark Garneau went right back to, you know, the lofty talk without having the – without really addressing – the parliamentary motion. And of course, I mean, there's the other side of this too. And, you know, China released a statement. The Chinese government released a statement basically telling Canada to mind its own business and it doesn't understand and shut up and we're China, deal with it. That was a too long didn't read version of the press release. But the but I mean,
it's accurate. We're China, deal with it.
It just, you know, what did they expect to come of this? Because the flip side of it too is that China's not, like, we're not a world power, right? We have no leverage at all. We're not a massive economy. We're not a massive military power. And I think this is, you know, there's something to the conservative mindset that makes them think that they want to be president of the United States, but they're not American, and they're the leader of Canada, but they're going to pretend anyway. I mean, Mulroney did that a lot. Stephen Harper did that a lot. And, you know, looking to what might happen next, there's nothing to say that China won't go out tomorrow, find two Canadians somewhere and throw them in a hole where they can't sleep because the lights are on 23 hours a day. That's what happened to the Michaels. All Canada did in that situation was, exercise an international warrant. We picked up somebody the United States wanted us to pick up. And then China picked up the two Michaels and, you know, have been torturing them for 2 years. So, you know, what is the end game O'Toole think is going to happen? Like, did he think China was going to go, oh, crap. They call it a genocide. Oh, crap. What are we going to do? Canada calls it a genocide, guys. You know, they were going to suddenly reopen the re-education camps and let the Uyghurs go on their way? No, of course not. And the retaliation could be biting. And when that happens, if that happens, China goes out and picks up two more Michaels somewhere, what is Aaron O'Toole going to do then? I'll tell you exactly what he's going to do. He's going to blame Trudeau, call him weak, and say that China doesn't respect him, even though he provoked this next phase of the crisis.
Well, that's it. I mean, everyone knows what the end game is in this. If Meng Wanzhou is let go, the Michaels will be released shortly thereafter. No question, in my mind at least. There's been some talk that's not exactly what's going to happen. This is, everyone knows this is why they are being held. That in itself is a separate story to what is going on with the Uyghurs. But to use that as sort of a springboard to, like, well, the Liberals aren't doing something on this, so we're going to get them via this back door by this non-binding symbolic resolution. It doesn't accomplish anything. Mm-hmm. It gives the illusion that something is happening. Nothing is happening. Although that's not completely true. Diplomacy is a dance, right? It's a long, slow dance marathon. And that is going on behind it with regardless of all the show that's going on, that diplomacy is still happening behind the scenes. Right.
Right.
But as you said, Canada is, you know, we need to tread carefully. We always default to the U.S., to the South. And it was reflected in that conversation that Joe Biden and Justin Trudeau had this week, sort of restating the friendship and Biden mentioning the Michaels by name and blowing one of their names, which is easy enough to do. But they're trying to get it on the radar with the U.S. saying, look, our friends of the U.S. are saying you need to treat these people better. How often do we need to turn to the U.S.? And you had mentioned Mulroney and Harper and other people in the past, because we are attached to them And they always have our backs. If they weren't there, the geopolitics of this would be completely different, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we can rely on the United States to just do our bidding in this. Although, doing the bidding would mean them dropping the charges against Meng Wanzhou. She is released. And then certain events will happen. And our friendship or relationship with China will improve. Because we can't, there's little leverage. Mm-hmm. And the way the world is now, the world pretty much we need them right now more than they need us, China, in terms of just strictly from an economic perspective,
mm-hmm.
whether it's getting PPE, you name it. It comes from there. Everything comes from there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, unless we set about developing this infrastructure we keep rumbling about, like, I don't know, making our own vaccines, we need them. So we can't, it's a dance. It is a delicate, delicate dance.
Yeah. It's like that fancy Australian dance in The Sound of Music that they do. It's not Dance Dance Revolution. It's complicated. Austrian? Yeah. Austrian. This, what did I say? Australian?
Well, Australia's coming up. So I understand.
I'm thinking ahead in the show, but no, it's complicated. It's nuanced. It's filled with tradition, and you know, as soon as you step on somebody's toes, the rhythm is off. And the thing is that when it comes to the Meng Wanzhou situation, like, we were caught in the middle. The United States was throwing its weight around with China and using us to do it and said, like, hey, she's coming in Vancouver Airport, pick her up. And we were like, yeah, okay, because it's a valid international warrant. So what are you going to do? Of course, China doesn't understand that, you know, in so much as they don't understand, like, democratic politics, and that, you know, one day you're dealing with Stephen Harper and next day you're dealing with Justin Trudeau, and they have completely different ideologies. Leaving that aside, though, Aaron O'Toole, I have a number of issues with, but I mean, just right off the bat, you know, I was listening to the Canada Land podcast, and they're talking about, like, conservatives now setting themselves up as, like, sort of the human rights observers of the Canadian Parliament. And I'm like, well, no, it's not even that at all. It's because Trump made China the big bad. So Canadian conservatives are now looking at China, making China the big bad for us. And not that it's not justified or understandable, because, I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, ISIS, they're all sort of on the ropes. And, you know, Hugo Chavez is long dead, no matter what people want us to think. But they're kind of the most obvious pick. And then he scores this victory. And it was a victory. It's a political victory, and it was also a human rights victory. I mean, it's important to say call a genocide when you see a genocide. But then almost right off the bat, he goes back to the meme wars, and he goes back and he makes this video. It's like, hey, everybody, I got a new office for Justin Trudeau. See that porta potty there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, great. Anything you just did to sow goodwill with, like, centrist voters in Canada, you just flushed that down the toilet because you had to make a porta potty joke about, yeah, we're gonna stick Justin Trudeau in there and that's gonna be his office.
I saw that on Twitter. It's extremely juvenile, right?
Oh, yeah.
And there is a place for that kind of gentle ribbing style of humor, but that is, he's just being a jerk. He's just being like, that's like frat boy style. Let's put him in the porta potty and tip it over and get covered in that blue stuff, right? Among other things. Yeah, it's just, he's being ridiculous.
And I will just
I don't know how you're supposed to take that guy seriously.
Right. And I will just add to the block amendment too. The 2022 Olympics, Winter Olympics in Beijing, I don't know where the bloc thinks they're going to move that to, because that was infamously the Winter Olympics nobody wanted, which is why it's in Beijing. It was between Beijing and Kazakhstan somewhere. So it's, you know, where are you going to move this Winter Olympics? Nobody wanted. Good luck with that.
Oh, they should have given it to Kazakhstan.
I'm
not going to make a Borat joke, but they should give it to him. It could make him the premier of the Olympics or whatever, the person that oversees the Olympics. And
it would have been.
Dick Pound will punch him out. I don't know.
It would have been very nice. Anyway, that's my Borat joke. Anyway, not very nice.
Very tasteful and not a frat boy joke, for sure.
Not very nice is how the Ontario government's been treating the environment the last few years, although. Stephen Clark, the minister for municipal affairs and housing, has suddenly discovered that he likes the Green Belt, and he wants to expand the Green Belt. And so they announced last week that they will be for 60 days. They are gathering feedback to see how people feel about expanding the Green Belt, including the Paris Gault Moraine, and which there is a bill to already protect the Paris Gault Moraine, which passed second reading, I think it was almost 2 years ago now. I mean, a lot of stuff's happened since then, so that's probably why it's still kind of stuck in committee. But, so conservatives love the environment now, Scotty. It's good news.
It's magic. Yeah, I think the official line is that the Green Belt is off the table, but there's a bit of an asterisk there in that it's like some of the Green Belt is off the table, because there's other parts of it that are... let's say, fairly desirable to certain people and are going to get beat on. Example, the new Highway 413.
Mm-hmm.
I saw one suggestion. I can't remember all the context. It's like, why don't they send traffic somehow, either trucks or otherwise, on the 407, which was built for this exact purpose, to get traffic yeah. off of the 401 and across. But no, the conservative government ancestors sold that, right? To private interests. Are we going to see the same thing with the 413? I don't know, but it seems misguided. The other thing going on too, as people have heard a lot about, are the ministerial zoning orders, or MZOs as they're called, that they're using as a hammer to bang development in lots of places with no discussion, no appeal, and no room for resistance, even though they always say, well, there's going to be a community input. A good example, and this isn't necessarily related to the Greenbelt, is the Dominion Foundry buildings in Toronto. Secret sale, MZO, just start knocking them down, and then people have to run to court, kind of like in Cambridge as well, to try and get that stopped. Slightly different, but the Ontario government owned it, they sold it, they won't say who they sold it to, but then, boom, something's going to go in, probably condos. But to treat the Greenbelt as developers treat things with trade-offs, and you see it all the time where it's like, if you give us this, if you let us put six more floors in, we will give you a little parquet nearby. That's this style. And this style is direct derivative. You know, their friends in real estate and development work that way, and it too applies to them as well, where it's the Greenbelt is this, not just the golden horseshoe of itself, but it's shaped like a horseshoe up to Tobermory. Like, supposedly it's the world's largest protected area, but if you're gonna pass something, not even pass it, just use an order and say, okay, we're gonna slap a warehouse onto a wetland just because we can, then that's not you protecting the Greenbelt. That's you saying a lot about protecting the Greenbelt while destroying it at the same time.
Yeah, that's the complex in Dufferin you're talking about. It's like kind of on the border of Pickering and Ajax.
Dufferin's Creek, it's called. Yeah. It's right. You know, again, rarish protected wetland. There's not a lot in that area. There's arguments coming out of Pickering that there are other places in Pickering where they could put that warehouse. Even I think one of them is even just up the road from where they're up. It's like, nope, it's going here because we want it to go here.
Right, and it's on the border of Ajax too, and so it's kind of like pitting municipalities against each other because it's right there on the border, and Ajax is like saying, no, we don't want this, and Pickering's like, well, we want it, we got an MZO, so in your face. And so you have two municipalities fighting each other and kind of ignoring the elephant in the room, handing out MZOs. But yeah, the highway thing I find fascinating because it was canceled by the previous Ontario government under Kathleen Wynne. The whole concept, like, they, you know, you can't build a highway in less than 30 years, apparently. But the, you know, it was under consideration. The Liberals said, no, that's okay, never mind, we're not going to go with this. I mean, it's known by many names, which is another problem with this. Like, it's Highway 413 or the GTA West Corridor, which, you know, kind of glams it up.
Through the Greenbelt.
Right.
It's like green on either side. Yeah.
Ooh, let's take a jaunty drive on the GTA West Corridor. But yeah, it was canceled by the Liberal government. And then the Conservative government puts it back on the table. And what's fascinating is that all the municipalities this passes through don't want any part of it. Mississauga City Council passed a unanimous resolution yesterday saying we are against this. Don't force it on us. And, you know, for Mississauga to be against more roads, that's...
Yeah, Mississauga, land of roads, yeah.
I mean, all roads lead out of Mississauga, and this is Mississauga saying, no, we don't want this road.
Having grown up there, that's very true, yeah.
I mean, basically, I hate to put it that way. Mississauga is a place where people live, theoretically.
But, we better stop the Mississauga bashing. It's going to be a problem.
It could be a problem.
Could be a problem. Probably won't.
The signal doesn't get that far. Anyway, it's just you do have these local governments saying no, and Brampton's the same way. Brampton, you know, Patrick Brown's trying to propose this kind of entryway, this kind of complete street scenario for where the 413 will pass by Brampton. And I found this trucker's sort of advocacy website that was saying, like, here's Patrick Brown with his boulevard, you know, trying to get in the way of trucks trying to deliver goods. And it's like, well, don't we have a lot of highways for this? And you're right. It's like basically it's trying to do what the 407 is trying to do. Of course, nobody takes the 407 because you have to pay to use it.
Worst deal ever.
Worst deal ever. I mean, and I think, you know, we can get into the...
Good deal for the people that bought it, but terrible deal for the people of Ontario.
Right, and we can get into the efficacy of toll roads or not toll roads, but I mean, just, like, privatizing it and selling it to, an outside Canada, even outside Canada company.
And a chunk of it isn't, though. That's the thing. Like, the newer piece of it that's going to go to Peterborough, it is not. So it's, like, it's... Not only is it kind of useless in places, it's very strange is the way it's set up. So
right,
but that deal must be rock solid and they can't undo it. I could see a similar fate at some point in history. I don't know when, we'll probably be long gone, that'll happen with the 413 as well. Mm-hmm. It'll be some kind of mess, and it's like, does it really achieve? Well, I mean, that's the 407 was supposed to achieve all kinds of development around it. Right. I don't think that happened. No. When you're on it, though, you can see the dilapidated farms and things that were just kind of left behind to fall into ruin.
Yeah.
So, do we care about arable land within the GTA scope? I don't really think so. Do we care about, wild places that are still somewhat wild, like wetlands and that, and need to be preserved for water supplies? Does the province care about those? The attitude they're taking right now, I don't think so. And it's the same... You know, to take it a step further, the attack on the conservation areas.
Right.
I watched a back and forth with Mike Schreiner and Doug Ford's parliamentary secretary, and she kept talking about, well, you know, they're too busy concentrating on zip lining in conservation areas rather than being conservation areas. It's like, why are you worried? The zip line is the least of the worries and probably costs nothing to do, right? So you're just running distraction with comments like that and not getting to the meat and potatoes of it. Is like, are we just going to pave over the province, what's left of it, or are we going to maintain some of the natural environment for the future? That is the question.
Well, this is it. They're selling it as a thing like, we got to get housing, we got to develop more housing. And it's like, I think a lot of people will agree with that. A lot of the housing issues and the issues with housing prices are... Yes, tied to the availability of stock. You know, in Guelph, for example, we have an almost zero vacancy rate. And when that happens and something goes on the market, of course it's going to go for the toppest of top dollars. However, they're doing it the cheap and easy and destructive way, which is to quickly sell greenland, farmland, just to developers willy-nilly and to do it without avoiding a lot of ugly public input, instead of doing the more expensive and probably the more correct option, which is to fix brownfields. I mean, there is a big hunk mm-hmm. of property down in your end of the city, 200 yep. Beverly Street, that is just waiting for somebody to put something up, but they can't because it's a toxic, dirty, sludgy yeah. place where there was a foundry for 80 years and there's just no money, or the money comes in very slowly to actually do something to clean it up and make it so that people can actually build something there and live there.
Well, they always say that, but a brownfield's a brownfield until it isn't. And I've just learned that in I lived in Lakeview, but Port Credit next door, they said the southern property, which was a tank farm of oil for since way back, since 100 years at least, and it was gone, paved over 30 years ago. They said, this is totally toxic. No one is ever going to live there. Well, guess what? They're going to build on it. So it's only toxic until it isn't, right? And that's an example, but you're right. And you know, that development, and lots of them aren't, it's definitely not going to be single family homes. The same with the Lakeview Generating Station, which was owned by the province. And you can't really afford to do that. Unless, I think some of this land grab, as we'll, or as I'll call it anyway, is to go with the single family home model, right? Which is an old model and not really sustainable. He says in the basement of his single family home, but it's tiny. It's a tiny house. But things have changed since my house was built 90 years ago. Right. So, these are all the things that need to be taken into consideration. And I actually am looking forward to seeing what's going to happen with, the lands over there. But, and I think we'll see a similar thing with the jail property, with the Guelph Reformatory. That's owned, if I understand it right, that's owned by three levels of government. The province will probably be the ones that steer it because of the jail. And that's a wait and see as well. But I think one of these days, and this is just my opinion, that we're accidentally going to see something happen to the jail, like a lightning strike, and then the historical elements of it are out of the way, and then they can build whatever the heck they want. But that is just my speculation. So, taking bets now. No, I'm not. We can't do that on the air. We can't do that. I take it back.
You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news, and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution.
That was the late Gil Scott Heron with one of my absolute favorites. The revolution will not be televised. I think it holds up. It was written in the, I think, early 70s, late 60s. But even on through to today, I don't think personally that the revolution is going to take place on social media. Maybe revolutionary chit-chat, but will it actually change anything? We don't know. But that sort of leads us into topic three, does it not?
Yeah, and I was going to say that a lot of those references do not hold up.
Like the Green Acres reference, like, yeah.
That, you know,
what's he talking about? Yeah,
young people, I mean, unless they get rebooted for Disney Plus, I think a lot of people are going to be confused.
Funky
yes.
Cut, though.
So, yeah, Facebook banned all Australian news outlets from posting or sharing, but actually also anybody who wanted to share, like, ooh, I see this story in the, I don't know any Australian newspapers, but, you know, here's this story about something going on in my community. Nope, Facebook wouldn't let you post it for a week, because Australia, doing the yeoman's work, I think, for most of civilization now, was trying to find a way to get Facebook and Alphabet as well, which is the parent company of Google, to start paying their share, their fair share for news content. Since things like Google News and Facebook, people are getting their news for free from basically those sites. Australia was trying to say, well, no, you should, you know, this is content on your site that you are getting for free, so you should be paying that to the content creators. And here's this law. And Facebook said, sucks to your law. We're going to ban you for a week. But now there seems to be some sort of deal. Basically, it sounds like Facebook is going to be able to choose who gets the money And I have to say, just as a news publisher myself, any idea of either the government or Facebook getting to choose who is news and who gets the rewards of that vis-a-vis money, I find frightening. Maybe, how about you, Scotty?
Yeah, this reminds me of playing soccer once. This kid kind of snapped, it would say, and just kind of picked up the ball, walked off the field, and started walking away in the middle of the game. That's what this reminds me of. Facebook is just doing this because they can.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, also to try and create some pressure. But as we know, this is what's killing. This is absolutely murdering news. Now, the news services that were fighting this are also giants, right? Mm-hmm. Seven West is Rupert Murdoch, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the news giants, this is giant on giant battle time, right? This is Godzilla versus whomever.
Yeah.
Fighting it out for the millions to get licensing deals, which seems to be happening. I believe Seven West has signed a licensing agreement for $30 million. Facebook has said, and it was I read it this morning, but I think it may have been yesterday, that they're going to offer up $1 billion over 3 years to support, quote, the news industry, which is vague enough to say, like, who are they going to give it to? They'll probably give it to people that suits them. And there's nothing in there about relinquishing the control of who sees what. So the city, you were talking Australian media, I think the Sydney Herald is a paper.
Mm-hmm.
This is the right kind of stuff that kills something like the Sydney Herald, because they don't get any revenue from their stories being shared. Facebook is proving that they can control all of it by shutting it down. You know, they always, we'll never do that. Well, these things are always possible. They just need to, like, turn the right screws, right? It's kind of like while North Korea can control their whole what passes as the internet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing this to force them to negotiate, but that, you know, to try and get the Australian government to back off. But now there's been concessions made, and they're having some kind of relationship again after a week in the wilderness or whatever. But yeah, I've heard this referred to as platform capitalism, and I think that's a great way to put it, where it's, you know, what does the platform create? Mm-hmm. It's more of an aggregate service, right? An aggregator. They just go, okay, we're going to take all this stuff, we're going to throw it at you, and because we've got the eyes and the prize, then we get the money, right? But where is journalism in this? Where is reporting in this? And as you said, like, your news service, or I would even extend that to setups like we have with CFRU and Campus Community Radio. Like, you mm-hmm. know, where are we in that? You need to listen by choice, hopefully, but so many people get all of their news from the internet now. Facebook, Google, they don't even bother going directly to a site, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, whatever the friends share, and then you go into that silo and down that rabbit hole or whatever you want to call it. Whereas, you know, it's not like the classic where not just getting the paper, but going to, say, I don't know, the Toronto Star or the New York Times. There's less and less of that, right? So mm-hmm. it just eats away at absolutely everything.
Yeah, the choice, I think, is sort of a key factor here. It used to be you would go to the newsstand or wherever you buy, you know, your paper. It would come to your house and you'd pick it up and you'd read it. You know, maybe you wouldn't read it cover to cover, but you would certainly flip through it cover to cover to get at the articles you want.
Oh, I read the whole thing. Even the ads. There you go.
But now it's like you hear you're scrolling through Facebook or Twitter, and it pops out, and there are, of course, algorithms that send you stories that are based on things you've previously looked at, and that's how you end up falling down some of those rabbit holes you were talking about. And we've seen this a lot. Young people who, you know, go on YouTube and look for video games and people playing video games, and then you get to Gamergate, and then you get to Gamergate, and you start going down misogynist rabbit holes, which then leads you to QAnon, and maybe even leads you to white supremacy. It's happened. It's been documented. It's either that, or you are, you know, looking for a specific story. Like, you hear a story about, you know, just to pull a Guelph news item out of my hat, like the patio district downtown, you hear that mm-hmm. might be coming back this summer, so you want to find some more information about it, so you Google it. You don't open the Guelph Mercury Tribune website and start looking for the story. It's more direct that way. So it is a matter of choice. Campbell Brown, who is Facebook's vice president of news, which is a real position, but she used to be a journalist herself, So you think she would know better. But she said, when it comes to Facebook, you have publishers choosing to post on Facebook. So Facebook doesn't really owe them anything. And to which I say to her, if you don't post on Facebook, you don't get seen. Facebook has rearranged the world so that people go to Facebook or to look for news, or people find news incidentally while scrolling through Facebook because their friends liked it or whatever. You have to be on Facebook or else you don't get noticed, because people don't, you know, go to the newsstand. Like, Facebook is essentially the newsstand now, except you don't pick up publications, you pick up articles. And I would further warn Campbell Brown that when you see these rankings for, like, the top 10 Facebook pages in any given day, it is inevitably Fox News, OANN, Newsmax, Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro. Like, they are usually, like, five of the top 10, and you know, you have
to open sources is in 10th, right? No.
Oh man, that would be sweet, because we're talking millions of clicks. But no, it's just, you know, is this what you're thinking about news too? And it's like, you know, there's a danger here that Facebook really essentially doesn't understand what news is or what news value is, because they get dinged on things like partisanship, and there's all these, you know, accusations going around about, you know, Facebook censoring conservative platforms and all that. So they automatically try to elevate things like the Daily Wire and OANN, because one of the N's is supposed to stand for news.
News-ish, just, yeah.
News-ish. I mean, that would be refreshing. I've been watching a lot of Unsolved Mysteries on Prime, like the yeah. like the OG Unsolved Mysteries, and of course it's every episode starts with like, this is not a news program, though we have used people involved with the story to help, you know, produce this segment, but this is not news. Yeah. And I was watching that the other day, and I was thinking, like, there should really be something like that before you watch a program on Fox News or something. It's just like, this is news adjacent, but it is not news.
That's like me with The Views Expressed. So here's yeah. the view. I believe Campbell Brown also said that there's Facebook gets little gain from news content.
That's horse hockey.
Absolutely. But part of that too is like, I think the gain is from those organizations that you listed. I believe that they are willing to pay to share. Now we and this is going to get deeply personal, but not necessarily in a bad way. We share around open sources, Facebook, Twitter, anywhere I can. I will pick 7 or 8 Facebook pages to share that this local show that we have is coming up. It never gets, it doesn't get any traction, but I bet, and I wanted to try it once, but I don't want to give Facebook any money, would be to pay for an ad and see who actually gets it, because then they would send that around to probably the entire listening area. I think you can draw that line and say, please send this to Cambridge, Fergus, whatever.
Yeah.
And then we would get some traction, and that's where the money's at, right? So yeah, there probably is little for them to gain on giving platforms like us, a little local news service, any traction. But you know what, it's kind of like that we were talking about before, the kind of non-binding thing. If they're saying, okay, we're gonna help out with local news, we're gonna support the news industry with X amount of money, is it going to be people that are doing actual news, or is it going to be some like Ben Shapiro, like you say, that guy's like it needs to be listed as an opinion piece rather than the news. And we know we've talked about this before, but it's like, this is an opinion show that overlaps with news. You are a local news person. Mm-hmm. I would call myself a presenter with, you know, technical capabilities at present. I have done interviews and stuff, but does all of that just get sidelined because the giants are battling it out for an ever shrinking market that they have helped shrink?
Well, I have bought Facebook ads just to you know,
and
test
how did
the
that
waters.
Go? What was the response like? Did you get more likes? Did you get more shares?
Oh, you get more response, but I like buy like $25 ads. I don't do like full like campaigns, like, because you can set it to reach as many people as you want, but of course, the more people you intend to reach, the more
like
it costs.
The world, yeah,
right. So it's not by any means a cheap process. So I've used it sparingly when I wanted to like promote something like an original investigative piece I've done, or a special episode of the podcast or something, or election coverage or something like that. So I have not used it a lot. I have used it sparingly, but it's a tough market because, you know, if you're a little guy, you don't have a lot to compete with. And then there's the dynamo of all the sites people already share. It's hard. It's really, really hard. And I was thinking about this too. I was like, there has to be a better way than letting Facebook choose who gets to count as news, or letting the government choose who gets to count it. Because there's a lot of that happening already. Like with the media fund to hire more journalists. I mean, the government is basically choosing winners and losers with that. And the winners are people with the infrastructure to expand. The government is not helping startups with those funds. So I was thinking, like, we shouldn't be choosing the government, and especially a mega tech company like Facebook should not be choosing who's a news outlet and who's not. I was thinking, like, well, should it be clicks? And I'm like, no, that doesn't feel right either. I mean, it would be more egalitarian in a sense, because you wouldn't have the government or Facebook choosing winners and losers, but people click on the stuff that makes them angry, or they click on the stuff like ephemera, like Arby's and Guelph closed. I remember how many, I don't remember how many clicks that got, but that was like the top story, Guelph news story on Facebook,
Taco Bell opened, and it was like, how does this have 1500 shares?
Yeah.
We get like one. I got to tell you my favorite though, because I guess we're almost out of time on this, was that I shared the open sources outline. I think it was on Overheard at Guelph, and somebody put, I'd rather listen to Nails on a Chalkboard. And then I said, that show's actually on at midnight, but you can check us out at 5 o'clock every Thursday. So,
was that Doug Ford?
Well, exactly. I don't know. It was somebody Ford-esque anyway. And if they're listening, you know, thank you for listening. All right. Nails on a Chalkboard will be on at about 2 a.m. So it's a whole show. Somebody just, no, it's not. It doesn't exist. It'll probably be the BBC. I don't know.
Fascinatingly, it's all show tunes. anyway, to wrap up. Yeah. Sorry?
It could happen.
It could happen, yeah. I mean, that's the great thing about community radio, is that literally anything can happen, except swears. Although that has been
there are times.
For our final topic this week, we are going to go into the past and revisit the Shawinigan Handshake, the infamous episode on Flag Day 25 years ago, this year, where Jean Chrétien choked a guy, forced him to the ground, popped one of his teeth out of his head, and he's been kind of doing that bit ever since. If you basically see Jean Chrétien and you want a selfie with him and ask him to do the Shawinigan Handshake, he will do it. And it's interesting diving into this story, because I had certainly forgotten the circumstances around this. Like, and there was a really great National Post sort of, I guess, explainer of like the history of it and what happened around it. But I mean, just looking back, just generally, like where we are now, in the culture with terms of like abuse and violence and things, I understand the circumstances around it, but I still can't. I mean, considering that he still does selfies with people doing the Shawinigan Handshake, and it's just like, no, this is not. I understand there were like extenuating circumstances and stuff, but like to do it for Instagram repeatedly,
including the prime minister, there's a shot of him doing it to Justin Trudeau, right?
Yeah, it's just there's something about that leaves a bad taste.
Yeah, and when you said we were going to discuss this, I personally can't believe that this is 25 years ago, because I remember it really well. But yeah, as you were saying, in terms of context, there was so much going on within that slice of time. Mm-hmm. And people forget, why was his reaction so severe? First of all, security details have changed. The RCMP, I think at the time, said, oh, no, no, there was no violation of security. No one gets that close to a prime minister or a president or anybody now. No one. It just doesn't happen because things like this can happen, right? But we need to remember that a few months before all this, and I know you know this, Adam, was that was the assassination attempt in his home.
Yeah.
On John Crutchan by a separatist, right?
Yeah.
This guy was went into the house, got into the house, and was going
to... A month after the referendum.
A month after, yeah, the 95 referendum, and was going to stab the prime minister to death, was his intent. I'm not sure what happened to that guy. We know what happened to the guy that was kind of choked. He ran for the Quebec Solidaire for a bit. I believe he's still alive. And I think he got paid for his dental work.
Yeah, you got $500.
What did he say? The RCMP came to the door with a check. He's like, okay. And supposedly, this was lost to time, too, that he spent the money on buying an ad slamming the Liberals. Because of this, something else that's forgotten in this, too, is what were the protests about? They were labeled by Sheila Copps and others as separatists.
Mm-hmm.
But these were the biggest cuts to, well, it was when unemployment insurance became employment insurance on a positive note. But the goalposts were moved so way fewer people could qualify for it.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of thing was trending. We had the Harris Tories, the famous or infamous Harris Tories, had just been elected in Ontario on a austerity ticket. And the Liberals of the time, which was Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin, when he was finance minister, not prime minister, riding that wave, saying how it was all about slaying the deficit. Then we're going to slay the deficit. We have to balance the budget. What can we do? We'll kick a bunch of people off of the unemployment now employment. So there was a ton of stuff going on, aside from the handshake itself, which has which won him a lot of points with the Sun readers I worked with in the warehouse back then. Is somebody put it up on the bulletin board? That wouldn't happen now, but that was somebody. You know, everybody's like, ah, the Liberals, the Liberals, the Liberals. He did that. He won a whole pile of votes among the working class, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It's strange times, man. Strange times.
Yeah.
Was a young man. Yeah.
The whole nature of the protest, too. And, it's a reminder that, in the 90s, you had the feds download onto the provinces. You had the provinces download onto municipalities. And then you had, at least in Ontario's case, you had the province say, oh, you can't run a deficit anymore and you can't run a debt. Like, sorry, we're just piling on a bunch of new services for you. And we can't, help you pay for them because we're trying to, cut our own spending and, by the way, you can't run deficits. And if you try, you're going to get attacked by a lot of those, working class people who hate deficits as a matter of sort of philosophy. If you're running a deficit, you can't be seen as fiscally prudent. And then we're still basically dealing with that today. Like, there is still no sort of really organized way of creating more social housing at the municipal level, and we're seeing the consequence of that. We're seeing the consequence of an unregulated housing market sort of run wild, where people are selling homes for $300,000 above the asking price because buyers from the GTA have that leverage. Meanwhile, there's no housing for people who could maybe afford it with a little bit of help. Guelph is kind of a unique case as a single tier municipality, where our social housing is run through the county, but we really kind of have no formal relationship with the county. And I mean, all of that is a much bigger topic than this, but I mean, it all starts in that place in the mid 90s, starting with Jean Chrétien. And I think he's kind of gotten him and Paul Martin, for that matter, have kind of gotten, been allowed to slide on this austerity and a lot of the problems it created started with them in the 1990s.
And it's because he's an elder now. It's easy for him just to do his Shawinigan handshake party trick and everybody goes ha ha ha, forgetting that those are like the most severe cuts post-war that Canada has seen compounded. Like, I personally don't think Ontario has ever recovered from that period, both from what was going on federally and provincially. And then as you were mentioning housing in terms of the way that works locally, where the city will say, well, it's the county's responsibility. There's this back and forth and nothing gets done. right? Mm-hmm. And they'll say, well, no, it was actually the province's responsibility, and that was taken away. God, we hate Mike Harris, blah, 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 which is 20-plus years ago now. Ernie Eves, you name it. Mm-hmm. Nothing gets done, right? So we just spend the rest of time spinning the wheels about what happened back then, or do people make efforts to try and make all of that recover? Or is it just throw the hands up? And now with COVID, too, it's like, oh, well, even there's not much we can't do anything. Our hands are tied. Mm-hmm. You can untie the hands. You mm-hmm. can untie the hands, right? So that's, yeah, remember those times. You could see it. You could see things going downhill for people that needed that leg up. Like, I've only ever applied for, it was unemployment insurance at the time, and I thought I qualified. I wasn't destitute, but it was close, and this was pre these days, and I didn't qualify. And then when they slid that bar, mm-hmm. right, they slid that. That's why there were these protests, right? That's why, and it, you know, there was, well, and 96, too, the effectively a general strike in Hamilton, right?
Right, the yeah.
Times were way different. I don't even think that would happen now. It could happen now because there's so many people, you know, lost their jobs, housing is still a problem. All of these things, there's still a problem, but there's no... I don't think there's any organizing. Plus, we're supposed to stay home. So as to we probably won't see the likes of that again, at least for a long time, right? But that's, the echoes of the Shawinigan handshake have rippled down to 2021 for sure.
Well, it's also like sort of the last sort of gasp of it's an undercurrent in Canadian politics, to be sure. But, you know, whether you're talking about Chrétien, the Shawinigan handshake, whether you're talking about, you know, Pierre Trudeau, just watch me, whether you're talking about, you know, going back to Robert Borden choking the British PM during a war council meeting in World War One. I mean, there has been this undercurrent of...
Yeah, no TikTok then, so it was okay.
Right, you know, it's, you know, you don't want to lean too hard on the Canadian PM because he might snap. No one's going to be worried about leaning on Justin Trudeau thinking he's going to snap, or Stephen Harper for that matter, or, you know, maybe an heir apparent like Chrystia Freeland, or Aaron O'Toole. It's there's a completely different era of Canadian politics where a prime minister could choke someone in front of a camera and it would not be a scandal. There was a time before the Shawinigan handshake, and there was a time after, and we are definitely in the time after.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned that just watch me moment, because that was in the days when a reporter could walk up to the prime minister who was just standing on the steps of Parliament Hill and ask him a question, and that's something that will never happen again as well. But yet, Trudeau, being the clever man that he was and thinking on his feet, made a comment that's probably the equivalent of his Shawinigan handshake, something which his son still uses. Mm-hmm. Just Watch Me has lived on, and it came out again of one of these spontaneous moments. There is, I would argue, there's no spontaneity in politics anymore. That it's just, it's all show now when you've got Trudeau Jr. running through a wedding and they take a picture as if it's something that's going to happen, but it was actually completely contrived.
Right.
You know, you're diminishing the whole thing, right? Now, I understand it for security reasons makes complete sense. Because, again, I forgot to mention it, but that was... I believe the Chrétiens, when the assassin was in Sussex Drive, were either packing for or unpacking from the funeral of Yitzhak Rabin, who was assassinated, right? So it's not like political assassination has gone away, but it's like...
Attempted assassination, for that matter, given what happened last summer.
Yes, but they didn't get anywhere near the governor general or the prime minister, right? So that's the difference. But could have, I suppose, right?
But I mean, there was also the one of the same group also like was accosting Jagmeet Singh and other government officials. So it's not like the danger isn't real. It's
I can guarantee that Jagmeet Singh isn't walking that walk across the bridge anymore because of some QAnon jerk off. Regardless of your politics, those people need to just. Take that, jerk off. Can I say that? I don't know. That's not on the forbidden list, is it? That's me being spontaneous and apolitical. I'm using words like that on...
I think it's safer...
We'll let it go. I will take the reprimand if there's one coming. Bring it.
Well, I was going to say, even at that, it's the show is over. So, if you made it this far, you got to hear Scotty say jerk off several times in succession.
Because he really wants to say something else, but isn't allowed to. So, yeah.
Well, if
another
you enjoyed...
day, another time, another podcast. Yeah. Whatever.
Yeah. If you enjoyed that, stay tuned for Open Sources After Dark. But until then, that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. If you want to stay connected to us, you can go to our website, opensourcesguelph.com. We're on Facebook, the dreaded Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, or
take
on
it
Twitter.
Back, Facebook. Oh.
At @OS_Guelph. You can listen to the show again by downloading it from our website every Monday at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through a podcast app like Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can find my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook for now. Scotty Hertz on Twitter. Please check out the CFRU website, CFRU.ca, which has all scheduling information and everything that's going on at the station, hopefully. But you can also tune in here anytime, 93.3 FM, 24/7 Campus Community Radio.
And stay tuned for another great show. DJ Sounds Good to Me. She's here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will, of course, be back next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more Open Sources, and we will see you then.